and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order Thursday, February 8th, 2007. And today we're doing getting some background or foundation in insurance or principles of insurance. We're calling it Insurance 101. And then the Council on Health Plans representative, Catherine Commit, will talk about HMOs in Minnesota. I don't know why it says group health. But anyway, it's that's what we'll be doing for the day. I hope that other members will come because I think it's been a while since we've actually listened to a presentation about just the fundamentals or the principles of insurance and how it works. And most of the bills that we deal with, you know, I suppose it varies from year to year, but it seems to me that most of the bills we've dealt with since I've served on the committee have been about insurance. And I think we're going to be hearing a couple of really major insurance bills coming up shortly in this committee. We'll be hearing Senator Berglund's, is it Senate File 2? We will, and by the way, members, particularly for the new people on the committee, we're not going to get into pieces of the bill that don't deal with our concerns. So we're not going to be tinkering with people's bills over in areas that have nothing to do with our committee's jurisdiction. I'm going to try to sustain that principle in all cases, on all bills. So, Senator Berglund's bill, we're not sure when that's coming out of Senator Marty's committee, but it will come here following that. But we will have jurisdiction. It seems to me that there were just, out of 40-some sections, we just had less than 10 sections, I think, that concern our jurisdiction, if you will. And then Senator Betzold, statewide health insurance coverage for education, the education community, meaning all employees of school districts, that will be coming to us. Right now it's scheduled for the 15th. So sure. I guess that's next Thursday. Doesn't look like Senator Berglund's bill can get to us by next Tuesday because they haven't finished it. So that will probably be the following Tuesday. And I think some other bills, I don't know if that was on the official schedule yet, but we had talked to some other authors. You know, Senator Sparks, you had one of the bills. We're just going to push you back a little bit, but and hope that that's okay. I think Senator Olsen and Senator Prettner-Solon, yeah. If you don't mind, that's going to be, delayed a little bit. Otherwise, we're not going to meet on the 22nd. Is that correct? Yeah. That's the Mancini's event that a lot of people like to go to, and it's during our committee time, and we've tried, I think, in the past not to do that. But so, and we don't have a whole, we don't have a truckload of bills yet, so that's probably good news for the rest of the world. Can only hope. But anyway, Mr. Johnson, Bob Johnson is here and has helped me learn a lot about the principles of insurance. I'm still learning. Mr. Johnson, thank you so much. He's I don't know what your title is at the Insurance Federation because it changed in the last year, I think. But
I'm the president of the Insurance Federation.
Okay, then we will.
Ooh. The same lobbyist. That's
so welcome, and thank you so much ahead of time. And I know if members have questions, are you fine answering them as we go along?
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, and the primary benefit, I think, is for me to be responsive whenever you all have questions. So this is, I don't have a formal text I'm following, so deliberately to be flexible, because most importantly, I want to be responsive and help on any kind of basic information, system issues. What I'd like to do is just provide some brief background, and then in the handouts, I'll identify when I get to that. There's just a couple of schematics, kind of pictures, one of which walks through the basic insurance transaction, and I'll walk through the steps of that, and then another schematic that tracks the dollars. Once they come into an insurance company, where do the dollars go, what happens with them, and then at the end of that. And then lastly, Madam Chair, just give some overview comments about the marketplace, the auto partners, work comp, life, annuity, disability, whichever, and I'm really flexible with you, Madam Chair, and the committee members, kind of however, if you want to crack one of those open and get into it, if the time permits, I can try to do that, and there's other minds here that we can probably get whatever questions answered that the committee has. But that's the game plan, and again, I'm flexible on the time. The only thing I'll say on qualifications is that I do have the benefit of having been in one job for 30 years and represented a group of companies that write all these lines, and I've worked with these chapters of Minnesota statute since 1977, so I'm familiar with the statutes and the industry and the companies and, frankly, the issues that have come up here for the last 30 years. So I have that historical perspective and can respond to questions about that if the committee would like to get into that. I did, Madam Chair, in the handouts, and Mr. Stengel recognized this, but there is a two-page handout, and it's just right off the revisers section of the web page that just lists the chapters of Minnesota statutes that this committee has jurisdiction over and that the Commerce Department works with. It's just not something you regularly pick up and look at that. But what I will do is when I walk through these is just reference where some of these statutes fit in to the key parts of the insurance transactions. And this is an industry that's regulated at the state level, and there is a fair amount, a lot of regulation. I didn't make copies of, Madam Chair, but I think also there are 750 pages of formally promulgated Minnesota rules in the Minnesota rule books representing 46 officially promulgated rules governing and that have been done by the Minnesota Commerce Department. And, of course, those are laws that the insurance industry is subject to. So, and the titles of the rules that have been promulgated track pretty closely with what you see on the listing of the statutes. But I didn't. And in many cases, there's even a greater level of detail and specifics and requirements that are put in place in those rules. So that's really kind of the game plan, and I think we can get at all this and be responsive again to the questions that any of you have. Actually, all this started in America in 1752 when Benjamin Franklin formed the first fire insurance company. That's when it all launched, 1752, and he patterned that insurance company off of the insurance companies that were formed in England after the London Fire of 1666. So I'm not a historian, but that's as much history as I have on it. And really out of that was the basis. And from that, the insurance companies and the lines of insurance developed and evolved. We have, as Commissioner Wilson, many of you may recall, he actually gave some good background on regulation, the number of licensed companies, who all is doing business here. But really at its core, and the reason it's formed, it's all based on risk. I think each one of us wake up in the morning and look at, in the course of the day, the risk that we are all subjected to or that have as a result of living in society, as individuals, as organizations, so the risk of property loss, of health injuries, unanticipated, unexpected events, developments that can happen to us. And insurance is the mechanism to manage that risk. That's really what it is and why it's evolved in society. And so that risk of a large loss, and it permits an individual and an organization to really exchange that risk of loss for known certain periodic payments that are called premiums. So exchanging of the risk of large loss, transfer to an insurance company, periodic fixed or known payments known as premiums, and all of it's that risk, and it's all embodied in a legal document called an insurance policy. The insurance policy specifies the rights, the obligations, the payment terms, conditions. There's obligations and responsibilities on the part of the insurance company, on the part of the individual organization buying the coverage, and again, it's all embodied in the insurance contract. There's really two dimensions or key elements to risk in the insurance world, frequency and the severity. Frequency is just how often do things happen. Severity is how much, how serious is that loss. And so there's a whole continuum of frequency, severity, and how the kinds of incidents in society. But at the core of it, those two key determinants of the terms, the conditions, the prices. Then in some key concepts that underlie the whole insurance transaction, I'll just reference these as pooling and the law of large numbers. The insurance mechanism really works. So the risk that I have of my house burning down, we each, if we have a house or property, have that risk. The larger the numbers that come together, the more predictable and certain you have in knowing, A, how much loss is there going to be in this whole pool of it, whether it's homeowners or automobile drivers. And so the pooling really provides a core basis for insurance companies to operate and to have the kind of predictability to be able to project into the future and to know what the kinds of losses that are going to be experienced to be able to accurately price or put a premium on that risk. So those are two key underlying concepts. And if you'll pick up the Insurance 101, and this is a glossy public document put together by one of the property casualty trade associations, the American Insurance Association. If you'll pick that one up and open the top cover, just open it one page, and at the bottom of the center column is a picture there, and it says insurance transaction. What I'd like to do, Madam Chair, and really this description of insurance transaction really underlies all lines of insurance. I'll do it in an overview way. There's a lot of details that vary, but this really is the key sequencing of the transaction when an individual or organization ends up buying an insurance policy and paying a premium for it. And I'll just walk through it, and when I walk through it, what I'll try to do is refer to some of the handout with the statutory references just to give you a picture of how the state current laws, the rules and laws, govern the transaction. And again, which affects how consumers in the state, the product, the coverages, and what they're paying for it. So the key, well then, okay, we'll just start. So the insurance transaction, the first step of the process is the application. And so, and I don't mean to be overly simple, so I'll just do this, and if I'll look for eyes, and if I'm overly simple, I since it's 101, I feel it's helpful to walk through it, and we can, again, get into any one of these issues and break it open and get into whatever level of detail. And I'm sure if the committee would like to do, I'd be happy to give you my best shot on that. So the application process, so the consumer is contacting oftentimes through an agent, but there's a lot of ways that contact is made. But let's say it's through an agent that makes the contact. There's a form and a process. Information is collected. There are laws governing that application process. We have statutes in here that specify sometimes information, how that information is collected. We have in Chapter 72, there's a trade practice statute that specifies the details of what information is collected, how it's collected, the privacy standards that insurers collect the information under. It's called the Insurance Fair Information Practices Law. So we have a separate state-developed Data Practices Act. Actually, the chief author of it was Senator John Marty in his first term legislature here. So it goes back to that time. So there's one law in particular that governs that first application process. So the consumer makes that initiation, fills out that application, whether through an agent or through whatever avenue that they've undertaken, submits it to the insurance company, and then the next step of it is the underwriting process. And again, so the underwriting process, depending on the line of coverage, whether it's personal lines, so the auto, the homeowners, whether it's the commercial coverages, so those are the two basic, at least in the property casualty, personal and commercial, for describing the types of coverages. And the underwriting process is each individual insurance company will determine their standards for evaluating the risk presented. So if it's an auto insurance policy, you'll see a multitude of companies. They don't have the same standards. There are some basic statutes, again, primarily in Chapter 72A, the Trade Practices Statute. You'll find a series of laws in there that actually specifically govern the underwriting process of insurance. So another, whether it's what information can be collected, what factors can be considered or not considered in that underwriting system. So, again, it's the insurance company looking at that information, They have, again, they each develop their own standards. We have, our state law in Minnesota requires that for licensed insurers, no underwriting standard can be used by them unless they have the numbers, the ability to justify, to substantiate that that's a factor that is fairly, that they can use it and they have the basis to substantiate and use it in that underwriting process. And so that step of the process then is out of which. So then decisions are going to be made by the companies, and in that underwriting process is the pricing or the determination of what the premium is for the individual. And when I finish this, I'll have a separate chart that I'm going to kind of walk through some of the premium-specific statutes in our state law and how it applies to that. At the end of the underwriting process then, so the companies have made those decisions, is the issuing the policy. So again, this time, as I indicated up front, this is the legal contract that embodies the rights, the obligation, the responsibilities, the coverages, deductibles, whatever the terms and conditions that have been agreed upon. We again have a number of state laws that specifically affect that. If you look at the last page of the statutes, for instance, there's a line there that's Chapter 72C that says the readability of insurance policies. We've had in Minnesota law for a number of years this statute, and most states have this, that requires the personal lines, the auto, homeowners, life, health policies are mandated by law to be readable at the ninth grade reading level. There is a computer model that you can. Well, state statutes would not pass this test, by the way, but they wouldn't. And the law that enacted this would never have passed the same test, but it's called the FLESH test. Some professor that developed this computer model that you drop language in, and it measures the length of sentences, the number of syllables in the words, and it actually determines if the document has got to meet a number. And so every policy sold in Minnesota complies, in those lines I indicated, complies with Chapter 72C. They're readable at the ninth grade level. Do people read their policies? Well, I don't know. I do, but not many people do. So some we won't ask for a show of hands who's read those four policies. But the point of it is to make a document from a consumer perspective that they can pick it up and be able to work through it in most cases. But in most cases, frankly, what happens is that an individual has something that happens and they'll call up their agent or whoever they're working with, if it's an agent or the company, and look for help to sort through what are the next steps to do. So there are other statutes that govern that, but that's the key one that I wanted to point out in terms of the issuance of the policy. And again, it's the legal contract, and it sets out the terms and conditions that govern, the behavior, the responsibilities, the obligations on both the insurer and the insured. The next step of the process is the claim. As if we look at that insurance transaction picture, if it occurs, and fortunately, most people don't have claims. Now back up to what I said up front for the law of large numbers, and in terms of how the insurance transaction works. It's because that most people don't have claims that when we have this large pool that we can pay a smaller premium to cover those losses of the few that have the extensive claim, that have claims rather. And so the systems, we have a number of laws that are specifically on point and govern how the claims transaction, how the claims are to be handled. Again, on that last page, the regulation of trade practices, particularly Chapter 72A, we have under Minnesota law, it's called the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act. And so there's likely bills, that usually every year there's bills introduced that in some way, shape, or form pull in the Claims Settlement Practices Act. And that really is the one of the, in addition to the contract itself, that spells out, again, the coverages, the terms, and how details about the claims and how they're to be submitted. But the Claim Settlement Practices Act is state law that has very specific standards that if we printed that and you looked at that, you'd see details regarding the obligation of insurance companies in terms of time frames that they're required to respond within, which communication to the insurer, to the individual about the process, and time frames for responding to and again, managing the flow of that claimed process. That law has, there's a section on health insurance claim. There's a section on automobile claims. There's a section on property claims. So you'll, again, and it's tailored because the contracts are different, the coverages are different, and so it's a law that's been evolved and shaped through the years. But again, it provides some certainty, some standards that the state has put in place in addition to the contract, which really I would describe their consumer protection statutes and uniform standards then that everybody is going to have, all insurers have to comply with, and consumers all have the benefit of those uniform standards. So that's the claim on the handout here, the glossy. This identifies some of the difference in terms of property claims, and I think people are aware of some of the core coverages. Property claim is a first-party claim. I buy coverage on a property, and there's a fire in the property. I own it. I submit that is a claim payment. It's a first-party claim. Another primary area of claims is called liability claims. So if I engage in conduct, if I run a red light and I crash into somebody, I'm negligent, I have some liability. If I run the light and run into Dominic Spizzetto here, then I buy liability. Well, he's sitting here and he represents agents, so that's all right. So the liability coverage is the coverage that I buy if I've engaged in that negligent behavior and I have a obligation to him financially for any damage that I've caused him. So that's a type of claim. So there's different systems in place for the processing of the property claim as opposed to this liability claim. Then the last step of the insurance transaction is renewal. And so most contracts in this state, they're either 6 months or 12 months. Now, I'm talking about primarily property casualty. If you buy a life insurance contract, it is for your life. It's for a longer duration. Other financial planning products, annuity contracts. So, but at least on those core property casualty, auto policies in Minnesota are 6 months. Homeowners policies are 12 months. So at the end of those contracts, so what happens? Well, again, we have very specific state laws and regulations that govern at the end of those contracts the insurance companies and their ability to the terminology would be if a company didn't continue to write a contract, it's called a non-renewal. And state law actually regulates the times when, at least in the per auto homeowners, when those companies can non-renew contracts and limits that. So state law specifies the terms and those conditions under which an insurance company can non-renew the contract. If a contract ends earlier than the end of its normal 6 or 12-month expiration, then that's termed a cancellation. And again, the contract has cancellation terms, but state law actually specifies the conditions under which companies can cancel policies. And it's as the expected things like non-payment of premium. If you don't pay the premium, they're not going to continue the coverage. There are other conditions that are specified that actually limit when you can cancel a contract. So again, this represents that's the last part of the transaction. And we have significant statutes that have been around for many years that govern that end point of those contracts. So with that, I guess I'll make just a couple of comments then about insurance regulation and the kinds of companies. And I maybe should have said it up front, but in the earlier chapters here, we have a number of state laws that govern, and I Commissioner Wilson went through some of this, that companies can't sell in this state unless they're licensed to sell. State law sets out the conditions that anybody who wants to bring a licensed company in Minnesota has to meet in terms of capital, the ability financially to operate. And so they have to do the filings. They have to satisfy against state law and the rules that have been developed to get a license before they can sell insurance here. And there is a considerable and ongoing regulation on an annual basis about the operations of all licensed companies in terms of their finances, in terms of independent CPA audits, in terms of their investments, in terms of really it's pretty comprehensive A to Z of company operations, where there is oversight, standards, and regulation. Agents have to be licensed, and we have state law, Chapter 60K on the front of the chart listing. It's entitled Insurance Producers, and again, sets out the standards in terms of pre-license education and what agents have to satisfy under state law to get a license. So Commissioner Wilson made some reference to that, to the, I believe he said there were 1,600 licensed companies operating in Minnesota, and I don't remember the number of licensed agents. I think it was 55,000 in terms of the number. So it's a big industry. It's across the country, and actually it's across the world in terms of international companies operating there. And then the formation of the companies, the types, there's, you know, stock companies where you have stock issuance and it's owned by the stockholders, mutual companies where the companies are owned by the policyholders. But there are other types of entities that sell in the state and operate. There's captive insurance companies. Madam Chair, unless somebody is interested, there's different ways that are legally recognized and permitted to form insurance companies. And at the core of it, it's just an entity, and it's a different organization and to transfer risk to. They have to follow those state laws that are applicable to them. There's risk retention groups, reciprocals, there's fraternals. There's a separate chapter in Minnesota, chapter 64, that governs the operations of how fraternals operate. So a Sons in Norway, a Catholic Aid, a Thriven. We have a very healthy and vibrant fraternal population or entity in terms of operating in Minnesota, based in Minnesota, and selling the coverages that they're permitted to sell in this state. And lastly, in terms of the type of companies operating, then there are under state law there are mechanisms created. And I'll use auto insurance, since auto insurance, all drivers in Minnesota are required to carry an auto policy. If they don't carry a policy, they've committed a crime. Well, if an individual can't get an auto policy, then they've got a dilemma. So state law creates mechanisms. Signed risk plans, they have different names, but statutorily created mechanisms that an individual or an organization can get coverage if they can't get it in the voluntary market. So again, there are state chapters here that specify these entities, their operations, how they're to run, and they provide a relief, if you will, in the mechanism. There's a work comp assigned risk plan. Employers are required to buy work comp insurance for their employees in the state. If they can't get it voluntarily, then the state has created an assigned risk plan, and that's managed by the Department of Commerce that guarantees that businesses can get access to a policy. And then lastly, in terms of at least the entities out there that individuals and organizations get coverage from, there are some federal insurance programs. On the back of the Insurance 101 document, the last couple of paragraphs specifies federally created insurance programs that you hear and read about. The National Flood Insurance Program, that's a federal program. It is underwritten by private insurance. It's managed that way, but the feds set it up and the feds control it. There's an overseas private investment corporation. There's the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act after 9/11 and the impact that was happening in reinsurance markets and for coverage because of the Terrorism Acts. The federal government responded and passed the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act as a mechanism to, frankly, manage the risk associated with terroristic acts or threats in America, frankly, to help stabilize marketplace access of coverage. When the 9/11 happened, for instance, I know this number, that the workers' compensation claims by themselves out of that incident, the two towers going down, totaled $4.4 billion. Work comp claims alone out of that. Well, let's put it in perspective. $4.4 billion is four times the size of the entire Minnesota work comp system, which is about $1 billion premium system a year. So those kinds of risks in society posed some some unique challenges that, again, that ultimately the decision was made. And it's continuing to be debated and discussed out in Washington about the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act. And then lastly is the Federal Crop Insurance Corporation. It deals with just what it says. So that's the other part of the landscape in terms of what consumers and organizations in Minnesota see and deal with in terms of handling risks in those areas. With that, the only other comment I want to make, Madam Chair, on the, at least that Insurance 101, is that I did, in the center of it, I'd only point out that one of the other functions, a core function of the insurance mechanism, is risk prevention and loss prevention in particular. So I won't read through it, but you can see particularly on the right side of that handout just a listing of some of the key national entities and organizations that directly get involved with this whole area of loss prevention, helping individuals, organizations, businesses, underwriters, laboratories, the National Fire Protection Association, the Institute for Business and Home Safety, some very credible organizations that have a lot of resources in them that help individuals, consumer groups, insurers, states manage the risks involved and frankly help prevent losses. It's one of the, again, core functions of the insurance mechanism. With that, if you want to pick up the Insurance 201, it's really Insurance 101 still, so labeled it that way, and open it up. I'll briefly, Madam Chair, talk about the premium dollar, tracking it, and just give some description about that. And then I'll end with just some overview comments about the markets, the Minnesota markets, and just a little bit about how big they are. And if there's any questions about that, then we can maybe get into that. But so what happens when a premium dollar comes to an insurance company? So they've determined the premium they need. And I'll make this comment up front, Madam Chair. Generally, what you'll find in our state laws, and you'll find this of most laws around the country, is that insurance premiums, the key summary words that are used, premiums, and there's three standards that you'll find in law. Premiums need to, they have to meet the standards of not being excessive, not inadequate, and not unfairly discriminatory. Those are the three you'll written in state law and in most state laws. And it's been the case for really the history of insurance. So excessive means what it means. It's not too high for the risk presented. Insurance companies, through their actuaries, and the branch of mathematics that's involved here is called the actuarial science. It's the number crunchers and keepers and that aspect of insurance operations. But the inadequate standard also means just what that word says. If insurance companies don't charge enough money, then they're going to go broke. And so they have to collect enough money to pay the claims, so they're there if that end of that transaction happens. We want the insurance companies to be up and functioning, able to pay claims. So excessive, inadequate, and then not unfairly discriminatory. Again, those are the key phrases and the key standards that legally have to be met in the rate filing process. All of that is done through some specific statutes and the filings, the rate filings. Commissioner Wilson talked about the actuaries at the department, and that's the expertise. The private sector has it, government has it in regulation, to make certain that the rate filings meet those standards, that they're collecting enough money, that they're not charging too much, and that it's not unfairly discriminatory. I think then when the companies meet that, they take those rates out in competitive marketplace, and then they compete. And so I think in most lines and in most states, competitive markets is, I think, the fair description of what consumers and organizations see, which is good. I think competitive markets believe in competitive markets. They serve that function of checking and I think giving consumers the ability to choose and shop and look around for alternatives. So if on the box on that third page, I'll just briefly talk about this, because this is a core transaction. What insurers, when they're charging the premiums, of course, what unlike like making a wagon or something where you know all the costs of the commodity when you make the wagon and you get done with it and you know the labor and you know the materials and you know all that, insurance companies are predicting or looking into the future for claims that haven't happened yet. So that at the core of what the pricing is that trying to accurately predict what's going to happen and the amount of losses that are going to happen. Insurance companies, they look at historical data. There's very extensive historical data on life and financial planning side of it. You have mortality tables and the references that you all have heard that have big, credible databases that tell us all how long people live and at what age, how many years do they have, you know, by the tables and the numbers. That's the kind of number crunching. The workers' compensation system in Minnesota has a very extensive data collection system. It's regulated by state law that tracks employer information by classification code. So if anybody has been associated with or knows a business operation, businesses are grouped by four-digit codes. Data is collected. Very extensive data is collected by that four-digit code, and that provides the database to look into the future to predict what are the claims going to be of a grocery store, what are the claims going to be of a trucking company. So, again, accurately predicting and having a significant enough data to be able to do that is a key important function. But when the money comes into the company, and I'll just work off of the chart, Madam Chair, you can see that the premiums come in, and there are two things that happen. Investments, and the investments of insurance companies are specifically controlled by state law. There's a chapter that actually specifies the percents and the brackets, how much can be in stocks, how much can be in bonds, how much can be in real estate, how much can be in. So it's very specific, very detailed. Probably two-thirds of most insurance companies' investments go in bonds, both government bonds and corporate bonds. Around two-thirds, it's probably less than 20%, is involved in stock market asset investments. And I think the kind of the safety, the security is an important determinant of that. In addition to where there's invested assets, and so those premiums are put in a percentage of them in that until they're needed to pay claims. The other where dollars, once they come into an insurance company, goes to expenses. And clearly it costs money to operate an insurance company. And I'll use the auto insurance system, and it's pretty reflective. It's the numbers do vary, but auto insurance is pretty reflective. If an insurance company collects a dollar of premium, that out of that dollar, about 25%, and these are nationwide statistics, that there's some very good data sources that compile premiums and cost information on a nationwide basis. But out of that dollar, again, about 25 cents of the dollar is going to be going to expenses out of an insurance in the insurance system. Probably about 15 cents out of that, 25 cents of expenses go to agent commissions. There's about 5 or 6% to go to company overhead operations. There's a premium tax in there of 2%. And so just, again, reflective of that expense box in the system. Then the bulk of the dollar that's collected in that auto insurance transaction goes to pay claims. So if it's 75 cents out of the dollar, a premium goes to pay claims. Auto insurance would be an example of a system where it's a relatively short turnaround. In other words, most of the claims that, in the course of a year, what's happened in the auto accidents. It may take some time to process some of them, depending on, but the overwhelming majority happen within the time. So it's we would term it as it's a short tail type of insurance system in contrast to a system like workers' compensation, where if a dollar's collected, many claims don't even appear for a period of time. So that's a longer tail, and so the dollars are having to be invested and kept, and there's literally a pattern that we could show you on what would happen with that work comp dollar, and you probably have to get out more like 8 or 9 years off of the end of a year before you'll see most of the claims coming in and being paid out. So that pattern varies by line, and again, the ones that the money is turned around in a shorter amount of time, the investments are less significant because the dollars aren't there that long, and so that's why more conservative investment, there's lower yields in those more conservative investments. But I know that the insurance industry is probably the largest holder of corporate and government municipal bonds in the country, probably in the world. It's a lot. And that's by nature of how they're set up and how they need to have that money turned around. So that's how it's done. But at the end of all that, then, so the money is invested. It's used for claims. There's two parts to that transaction where, as you'll see on the chart, one's called investment gain or loss. Another one's called underwriting gain or loss. Really what it means is that for most insurance companies, when they're trying to predict the claims, they know there's an investment component. It is included in all of the rate filings that are done, which are, once they're approved, they're public documents. So it's the system, I think Commissioner Wilson talked about, or Deputy Commissioner Kevin Murphy might have talked about that. It's kind of the accessing some of the filings and how that operates. But clearly investment earnings are directly part of the system, are part of the rate filings, are part of what's contemplated in operations. At the end of that, the capital that underlies or that supports each individual insurer is called policyholder surplus. So that's their capital account. And again, all of these pieces this part of the insurance operations are governed by specific state laws, state rules, filings, and the operations of Commissioner Wilson at the Commerce Department. So with that part of it, what I thought, Madam Chair, if you'd like, or if you want me to stop and take a breath, is I thought it'd be helpful to talk a little bit about just the auto insurance market, the homeowners market, maybe the work comp market, a little bit, if you'd like, about the life, annuity, long-term care. I guess I know Catherine's going to do health insurance, so I'll stay away from that, except to say this. Health insurance is maybe, it's the one that's got the most unique attributes of it. Okay. And it's got the most unique attributes of it because of federal law. Okay, so this is, Catherine will get into this, but no other insurance system that'll come before this committee has that aspect to it where there is a federal law that's been passed under which the individuals or the businesses in the state can buy coverage, and then that federal law preempts anything or everything in state law. Health insurance is the one system that has that dimension to it.
I was going to ask you a question, and I don't want to get you off
that's fine.
Target here. And I'm not sure if I should wait till you get to homeowners or whatever, but I think the issue has arisen under homeowners that I've read about. And now I see something here in the 201 on the third page, having to do with losses in one state not being subsidized by the fact that, you know, we didn't have a hurricane,
right,
Katrina here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, and I should have said that, when I talked about claim payments and losses, Minnesota consumers are paying premiums based on Minnesota claims and what's been filed in this state. And so state law requires that. Insurance companies in Minnesota can't, as part of a rate filing here, and homeowners in any way, shape, or form include in that filing catastrophe losses coming out of Florida. And I included in the packet, and it's primarily to illustrate that very point, was just in it, a one-page fact sheet on average auto insurance premiums by state. And I put that in there just to those numbers are taken out of, and I had indicated to Senator Scheid that a book that's worthwhile to get, the Insurance Fact Book by the Insurance Information Institute. It's an annual publication that's got more specifics about virtually, it's just facts about literally all lines of insurance, coverages, dollar amounts, by state, by year, by company. It's just a helpful fact book. Reporters, media outlets nationwide routinely, this is not a lobbying book, it's a fact book taken out of data that's filed with regulators, and it's a useful tool. But I just pulled out of that the average, and it's done annually, auto premiums to indicate, Madam Chair, that very point. In other words, what consumers pay in states, frankly, varies quite a lot. And it varies because the claims experience in that states vary quite a bit. And so in Minnesota, clearly our no-fault law, because it's, frankly, in most cases, you have the same companies selling here, selling in Wisconsin, selling in Louisiana, selling in Florida. Not entirely, but there's a lot pretty similar. But the results are very different, and they're different because the claim payments are very different on a state-by-state basis.
Did you have a question? Oh, Senator Olson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, when you gave your presentation, you mentioned that about 25% of every dollar collected in premiums goes to expenses, and then you said the other 75% is paid out in claims. And actually, I think what you meant to say, or at least what your brochure says, is that 75 cents of it goes to claim-related costs, and not all of that, I believe, is paid out in claims. Isn't a significant amount of that actually paid to adjusters and litigation expenses and other claim-related costs?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the majority of that is paid in claims.
So would your expenses then of litigation, for example, would be under that expense?
Under the data that I presented out of the fact book, which is nationwide auto
okay.
statistics, the cost of litigating, if it's auto insurance, would be in the 25 cents.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Do you know over the last, say, 20-year period, whether the percentage of that dollar paid out in claims as related to the percentage kept, whether, you know, for whatever purpose, has grown or decreased or what that's done?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator
Johnson.
Olson, it's been pretty constant. What I did say is that by line of insurance, there are some significant variations. In other words, the auto insurance is pretty different because it's a pretty quick turnaround. That'd be in pretty sharp contrast to a line like medical malpractice, where there are more of the litigation-related costs in that system. That number would be higher than that 25%. But there's a longer time frame over which it works. But actually, I think the numbers on expenses, and we could actually just pull them over the last 10 years and get them exactly to you. It's varied some, but it's been pretty consistent because the tax level has been pretty consistent. Commission level has been pretty consistent. In the marketplace, what's more likely happened is that you've seen the marketplace evolve, so there's more today where consumers go on the Internet and shop. So there's companies out there that sell at different expense levels than other companies. So there's been some movement in the market amongst the type of companies, but that goes under the competitive model, and if companies can cut costs in one area and get it to the consumers and sell it, then that's happened quite a bit. But I can pull the numbers and get you exactly what to see if I actually off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure it's been consistent, but I can get the numbers and show you exactly what it's been.
I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Johnson. The test is only going to be on 101 members, so you don't have to worry about it.
The last thing, Madam Chair, if I could, what I wanted to just say, if I can, just a couple of clauses here, is that just in terms of the size of the markets, auto insurance in Minnesota is about a $3 billion market, a little bit over that. Collectively, what consumers pay in Minnesota is probably about $3.2 billion. Workers' compensation in this state is about $1.1 billion, what employers pay collectively. The homeowners insurance market is about $1.2 billion, what everybody pays in this state. The life insurance, the disability numbers are bigger, and I actually don't have them here, but I'll get those and follow up. We have the numbers on what Minnesotans collectively pay in those columns. The newest product, really, on the marketplace and that all of this scenario would be long-term care insurance, and there's been quite a bit of debate and actually action by the legislature in recent years to grow the long-term care market. And last year, this legislature enacted the state law to promote this a federal partnership law and program that's is going on right now with the industry and the regulators and Department of Commerce and DHS and entities to position Minnesota to to frankly grow, but it's a new market in terms of compared to all the other lines of insurance in the state.
Was that Senator Berglund's bill, I think, that this committee
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chairman.
And I'm just wondering how many – oh, go ahead, Senator Metzen.
You know what we ought to do, and I – on this long-term care stuff, I mean, the state, you get a – I believe it's a $100 deduction or something.
Credit.
Now – pretend, and I don't know the numbers, that I pay $4,000 or $5,000 a year for my wife and myself for this stuff at the other end. And now that money will not be paid for by the taxpayers because I'm doing it. I could say, like others, the hell with it, why do it? Let somebody else take care of it. You know, and I could let me. My point is that I don't know, I should do some research on this. Why not figure out a method where there's a little more tax credit for incentives for everybody to buy in? Because in the long run, that's going to save a ton of dough for the taxpayers. And it'll cost something up front, I understand that. But $100 to encourage somebody to take out this $4,000 a year policy, well, I don't know. Does that make any sense? I mean, anybody looking at this? What do other states do? I mean, you want people to buy this product. Because it's going to cost the taxpayers $38,000 to $50,000 a year to take care of me at the nursing home. And it's not going to cost you now because I'm doing it on my own. Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, Senator Manson, we're right with you.
How can we encourage, Madam Chair, and what would it cost the state instead of the $100 of people?
Well, I know that the Senator Berglund's bill does have a – is there a provision with that federal – collaborative effort that your premium would roll over and you would, I don't know how it works, but
we have somebody here that can answer this.
Well, that's all right.
No, but actually, Senator Metzen, we agree completely on the need for and the benefit and are really working with the legislative leadership to do everything I think that we can to grow, promote, develop, to get the product out there, because as you described it, when the budget committees look at the budget numbers, they kind of blow off the top of the chart. And I think the private sector has an important role, and it should, and we're doing everything we can. This partnership program, though, and Robin Rowan can give you a thumbnail, but are working diligently, actually, to advance this in Minnesota, which will help, Senator Metzen, what you just asked about.
Ms. Rowan, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just very briefly, what the partnership does is it allows you an additional amount of asset protection should you need medical assistance in the same amount as the coverage that you bought. So say you add $100,000 worth of coverage in your long-term care policy. Sorry, I'm actually out of breath from walking over there. $1,000 for your long-term care coverage, you would then get to protect an additional $100,000 worth of assets should you need to go medical assistance.
Oh.
So the purpose is to encourage people to take responsibility for as much of their needs as they can before they go on to the state program.
Oh, I didn't know all that.
That was Senator Berglund's bill. That's what.
That's Senator Berglund's bill, and that's what we are.
That's law today. Sure, it's
bill. Okay.
That law? Is that in law now?
Yes, it's a federal law, and it's corresponding state law, Madam Chair, Senator Metzen. And we are hopeful. We're in the middle. Not unlike many federal programs, the federal government left a great deal of detail to the states to figure out on their own. So we are in the process of working very closely with Commerce and DHS to get the program out and rolling, and we're hopeful that maybe policies will be ready for purchase by April 1st. Hoping.
Did that, Ms. Rowan, did that end up in the omnibus insurance bill last year? Or did it go?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it ended up in many places, and one of them was, in fact, the omnibus insurance bill.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, you get
it. Yes, Senator Metzen.
Somebody will get it at the end, I guess.
Yes.
You've got to wait a while for the heirs or somebody to get it, but. It's not encouraging me to buy it, but it would. my wife, or whoever survives, she had to get the 100 big ones. All right. What's some incentive now?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, we'd be happy to work with you on a tax credit bill. We agree and are very supportive of that concept.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, did you have anything? Okay. Are there questions from members? One of the things I wanted to point out on the auto insurance premiums was to point out what I know to be the no-fault states. Number one, was District of Columbia?
It's not.
So number one, number three, number four, number six, number 10. So five out of the top 10 are no-fault states. Am I correct? Is that five? One, two. New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, Florida, which is going away from it but has been, and Michigan are no-fault states. And then you'd come down to Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Hawaii, which used to be number one, I think, that you told me, Kentucky, Utah, and then down at the very end, North Dakota, where they must not have very many cars or very many. Couldn't be lawyers. Could it be a shortage of lawyers? So keeping that cost down.
Madam Chair, the numbers, Johnson, are that no-fault states reached their peak in 1978 at 17 states. A block of years, and we were one of the states in 1974, effective January 1, 1975, passed a no-fault system. Today, as you just flagged off this chart, Madam Chair, there are 12 states that have no-fault. Three of those are optional no-fault, so consumers can choose the traditional system or no-fault. So whether you count those as they are no-fault, but under the option, many consumers in those states don't choose the no-fault policy, and so that leaves nine. Florida's law officially goes away on October 1 of this year, so that'll be eight compulsory no-fault auto systems that will be in existence in America.
And, Mr. Johnson, what is the – do you know the rate of uninsured now? Is it a – well, I'll ask you.
Madam Chair, the numbers today, I think it's an estimate because committee members are aware or not, we've had a fortunate history over recent years with our enforcement of our compulsory auto system, and ended up, we repealed last year the random verification system that was on the books. But the last estimate that I saw was about 14%. It's an estimate. We actually, that's a little better number than the number that we had seen 2 years before that. Wisconsin's number is actually slightly lower.
And I noticed that they're I think Wisconsin is probably more similar to us than Iowa, for example, in terms of population, metropolitan area, and miles of road, I'm guessing. And Wisconsin is almost $200, almost 25% less in premium than we are.
Premium, so, and biggest difference is that Wisconsin isn't compulsory auto.
No, they don't have to buy it.
Live in Wisconsin, drive a car, and you do not have to buy a policy, but they do have a higher percentage of drivers that buy insurance than Minnesota has.
Yeah, and I guess, members, I'd say I don't think we're scofflaws. I think that it's an affordability issue, that why people drive without auto insurance. But I didn't want to make this into a pro-reform no-fault, but it doesn't...
That's pretty good, Chair.
That doesn't undermine the fact that I would like to. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, just because you brought up those points, I just feel compelled to respond.
No, that's fine. Senator Olson.
Just going back to the history of the no-fault law, and I'm sure that Mr. Johnson will correct me if I say anything that's not correct, but I believe that the no-fault law was enacted as a compromise. And it was a trade-off because at the same time that we enacted a no-fault law, we also enacted liability tort threshold limits so that you have to have a certain seriousness level of injury before you're allowed to bring a case under the tort. What normal tort law, you would be able to bring a case for any kind of damages, but this precluded less serious cases from being brought. So there was a value to our court system in terms of savings there. And there's also medical care being paid for under our the laws that exist today that would have to be paid for somewhere else if it wasn't paid for under the No-Fault Act. meaning that I'm not sure if this study's been done, but I'm wondering if those costs then wouldn't be transferred to health insurance or some other types of expense, because the need to pay for those medical claims isn't going to go away.
Well, and in an extremely serious accident, I think your health insurance, your medical coverage would kick in after, you know, the $20,000 if you'd met that.
Right. But in the less serious cases, if you're going to, assuming you need the medical care, it's going to have to be paid for somewhere. And so if it isn't paid for under the No Fault Act, it's going to have to be absorbed either by people personally out of their own pockets, or it's going to have to be, that cost is going to have to be factored into the cost of their medical care.
Right. And I mean, as it is, we're all paying for that regardless of, you know, I mean, I think that's where the difficulty comes in defining what kind of care we're paying for, and whether or not that's best, you know, for consumers. But Mr. Johnson, if you want
I'm
to say,
I'm chomping at the bit, Madam Chair, but I think I probably shouldn't open up the no-fault.
I apologize.
But if I could, just one fact of history, I think it is helpful, and it was spoken, Madam Chair, at the no-fault subcommittee that you had created a few years back, and 6 hours of testimony was taken on the history of the no-fault, and the chief author of the act, who I had a sandwich with about an hour and a half, Senator Jack Davies. And as he testified, and he was the chief author, and he said that this was not passed at either the request of the insurance industry. In fact, most of the industry opposed passage of no-fault auto. Part of the industry supported, but the majority didn't. And so I just share that because, A, it was the testimony of the chief author of it, and it is helpful because I think some of the history of it, there is some confusion sometimes about, you know, from whence it came and who was doing what in Minnesota. But so I'd be happy to on whatever occasion to sit and chat about some of those trade-offs and the dynamics and where we're at today and what's working and how it's working.
Sure. Thank you.
Members, any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for that. It's very helpful. Oh, you know, I did have one more question. I did have. On the law of large numbers, is that just a given, or can there be problems with that?
Madam Chair, well, you know, yes, there can be problems. And
what would be the pitfalls to look for?
I was hesitant, but I'll just mention it, and this may come before this committee soon.
Right. That's why I'm asking.
Another bill
is that,
and maybe Catherine will get into this, but in any event, pools. So I use the word pools, and then the law of large numbers, and frankly, particularly in this area through history, there have been attempts and efforts to organize groups of people into pools for health coverage, and I'll just state it this way, and I can prove it later, that the history of pools has not been good. In my opinion, the history of pools has not been good because the numbers haven't been large enough. If you don't have a big enough, an insurance company is frankly a large pool of risks. Now, they have to meet state law, very specific about capital, management, and all of the pieces to run an insurance company, but pools oftentimes are either outside of virtually all of those state laws, but there is a very explicit experience with pools, and I would describe it again because if the numbers aren't big enough, it's not a credible base from which you can operate, pay claims. And what happens is that people quickly see that if they don't have a big enough group, then you can have really bad losses that happen in the pool, and then the rest of the people in the pool kind of quickly start saying, I'm not paying for that. That's too much money. And so so the answer to your question is that the law of large numbers, and there's no magic to this, but that's got to be big enough so that, A, you're collecting enough so that the experience is credible enough to know, again, whether it's property claims or auto claims or liability claims or health claims. And because of this federal-state law interplay and the ability, there's debates out in Washington about association health plans and just a multitude of frankly, ways to organize individuals to try to make it cheaper. That's really kind of at the core of that. Some of them work, but some of them have not worked.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just in response to that, Mr. Johnson, I would say that I don't disagree with you about the concept of pooling, but as you pointed out from the very beginning of this dialogue, pooling is the concept that allows you to make a 25% withhold 25% for expenses and still be able to and be able to pay those claims, and that we have a number of insurance companies based on making the concept of pooling work. So the whole question is whether there's a better way to do it, defining the parameters however it is that people are allowed into these pools in the same way that you make those determinations. There's nothing unique about your industry that allows you to be able to do that better than perhaps any other type of pooling, just like we have with ERISA, self-insured programs or whatever. So the whole question becomes whether 25% of administrative costs is a reasonable amount to pay for that pooling.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the only comment I'd make back is that there is a difference in the following sense, that it, with insurance companies, we can look up and you can know the ground rules, the capitalization, the standards, the reserving, the financial, and that's not the case of other pools that at least I've seen or that have been formed. And I think the key thing at the end of it is that, lastly, is that with the insurance, and I actually didn't mention it, but under state law, if an insurance company goes insolvent, there's a state law that guarantees the claims of the individuals will be paid, a guarantee fund that provides the safety net so that the other companies step up to the plate for that. That is not the case. That is not the case. Outside of the state-regulated insurance box, that does not exist. So I'm just saying, when you put it on the table, you have to put all the pieces. And clearly, I mean, if somebody can figure out a way and they can grow it big enough and make it credible enough, there surely is an ability to do that today. Saying the track record of those pools that have formed has not been good around America. It's just, I know that's a true statement. I can, again, follow up later and kind of document the instances where it has not worked. But it's I mean, clearly, the debate's going to continue on ways to organize the risk. That's really what this is all about, and that's why there's captives and risk retention groups, and there's a number of, there's not magic in that. There's different alternative ways to structure the risk.
Members, Mr. Johnson, again, thank you very much. It's been very helpful, and there, this folder, I suggest, you know, you might want to keep it around, and to make reference yourself when insurance issues come up in front of us. It's just nice to go back. And now, Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council on Health Plans is going to talk to us about health insurance, health HMOs.
Good afternoon, members of the committee.
Welcome.
Kind of excited to be here. I want to ask you right off the bat, what time does your committee end? Not that I'm going to talk that long, but I just want to.
Besides yeah.
No, that.
10 minutes.
2 o'clock.
I'll just we're stand scheduled. For questions.
We can,
then.
We can be here till 2:45. That's the general.
My presentation will not be that long yet. But I do want to leave time for questions. Before I get started, I just want to point out that I distributed some packets of material. There's a big packet of material about a number of different health plans in Minnesota, and then a packet, a folder with some more materials about the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And there's some documents from the Department of Health as well as some tax information there, and we can talk about that later. But I wanted to make sure you had that information. And then I did pass out a handout that is a paper PowerPoint presentation. So that's the document we're going to be working from. So with that, I'm Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And on page 2, I just want to show you who all of our members are. The Council of Health Plans represents 8 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. Some of them are large and some of them are small. So I'm sure you'll recognize some of those names. On slide 3, our members are nonprofit organizations. We're licensed as nonprofit organizations, and that's a unique factor in Minnesota. We're the only state in the nation that requires all health plans to be nonprofit. As nonprofit organizations, our health plans are mission-driven, consumer-governed organizations that are based in the community. Minnesota Health Plans employ 16,000 people across the state, and we're local. We're locally based, and our employees live here. We very much want to be part of the solutions because we're part of the community. I'm just going to go through these slides kind of quickly. So page 4 gives you a little snapshot of our health insurance status here in Minnesota. We have a good story to tell here in Minnesota. We have one of the lowest rates of uninsured in the country, and we're consistently rated as either the first or second healthiest state in the nation. Most Minnesotans get their health care coverage through their employer, but that number is beginning to fall. And part of the reason for that decline is that some employers are dropping health coverage altogether. Some of it has been due to the struggling economy. Fewer people are working for employers who offer health coverage, and there are more part-time or seasonal jobs that just don't offer coverage. So, like Bob, I'm going to talk about some very elemental things, but on slide 5, the question is, why have insurance? And Bob addressed this also. So why have insurance? And the reason to have insurance is to protect you against an unpredictable, catastrophic financial loss. The purpose of health insurance is to pool many people together to spread or to share the costs generated by a small number of people. That gets to Bob's comments about pooling. Over the long run, risk pooling makes sense because almost everybody eventually needs expensive health care. It's more manageable to pay an average amount or a premium every month than to get hit all at once by medical bills that reach tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. In addition, studies have shown that when people are covered by insurance, they seek the care when they need it, rather than either waiting or delaying or avoiding it altogether. We can talk more about this if you're interested, about the importance of being able to have large pools and the problems associated with segregating risk. I won't get into that now, but that's something to follow up with. Let me just talk a little bit about some of the models of private health insurance. There's the indemnity model, which is the traditional model, and years ago, indemnity policies reimbursed on an 80-20 basis, with the insured paying the coinsurance and deductible, typically. There was little or no coordination of care. Indemnity policies have evolved over time, however, into products that use managed care techniques. Today, most people with private insurance have some form of managed care, meaning that coverage is most comprehensive when they see a doctor in a specified network. Care provided out of network may not be covered, or the policyholder may be required to pay more out of pocket. There are many different models. The newest model of consumer-directed is the consumer-directed health plan, and these models are characterized by sharing more of the cost with the consumer. Consumer-directed health plans are sold by both indemnity and managed care plans. I want to give a little context about the environment in which we operate and what's happened over the last 15 or so years. In the early 1990s, the state passed the Minnesota CARES subsidized insurance program for low-income working Minnesotans. But in addition to that landmark legislation were some small group reforms that were passed. The state had made changes to help small employers offer coverage, and they did that by requiring guaranteed issue, modified community rating, and minimum loss ratios, etc. Some national for-profit insurance companies decided that they didn't want to participate in the market any longer, and so they made the decision to leave the Minnesota marketplace. On slide 8, I want to talk a little bit about who the key partners are in this very complicated system. They all play an important role. The end users of health insurance are consumers or enrollees, though when they get sick and use their health insurance, we call them patients. Providers are also key stakeholders. What health insurance covers and how it reimburses for care is very important to hospitals, doctors, pharmaceutical companies, and other providers of care. Insurance companies are obviously key stakeholders. Their concerns include how markets work and how they are regulated. Employers are also major stakeholders because most people are covered by health insurance purchased by their employer. And policymakers have a major role in determining the public policy for the state. Regulators play a major role in overseeing how the laws and rules are implemented. On slide 9, I talk a little bit about what state government's role is, what your role is, and the state agency's roles are. Minnesota health plans have multiple regulators. The Department of Health regulates the health plans on quality measures such as utilization management, credentialing of providers, complaints and appeals, quality assurance, provider contracts, adequacy of provider networks, etc. The Department of Commerce's job is to ensure that the health plans are solvent. Minnesota had a problem in the late 1980s with some health plans pulling out when they couldn't make it financially. The Department of Commerce protects consumers by making sure the health plan is adequately funded to be able to pay claims. Doerr and DHS are major purchasers of health care. Doerr purchases coverage through the health plans for Minnesota state employees and their dependents. DHS purchases health care coverage for most of its Medicaid population and all of the Minnesota care population through the health plans. But DHS also acts as a regulator with many state and federal requirements on health plans that serve government program enrollees. Policymakers like yourselves determine the public policy direction for the state. Admittedly, your job can be difficult. You must balance the moral imperatives, such as the right to unlimited health care, against limited resources. However, as state lawmakers, your reach has some limits. This is where Bob was talking a little bit about the federal ERISA law. ERISA, you'll hear a lot about for new members. ERISA is the main federal law governing employer-sponsored health benefits. ERISA stands for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1973. Initially, it was a pension law. Congress enacted ERISA to establish uniform federal standards to protect private employee pension plans. But ERISA also covers most other types of employee benefit plans, including health plans. Large employers typically self-insure, meaning they have the financial resources to assume the risk for the health care costs of their employees. These employers are referred to as self-insured or self-funded because they assume the financial risk for the health care costs. Typically, the large employer will hire a health plan or an insurance company to administer the health insurance benefits to its employees. By self-insuring, the employer is exempt from state laws, rules, mandates, and taxes. Or said another way, the ERISA law preempts state laws, rules, mandates, and taxes on these plans. Smaller employers typically cannot assume the financial risk for the health care costs of their employees, so they transfer the risk to the insurance company directly. These types of plans are called fully insured, meaning the employer pays a premium to buy an insurance policy for its employees and transfers the financial risk from the employer to the insurance company. So the next page shows a graph of, it's actually two pie charts of where Minnesotans get their health insurance. And the top pie chart is a snapshot of what it looked like in 1993. And this is, I think this is a really illustrative way to show how much the self-insured market has grown. Today, more than 40% of Minnesotans get their coverage through self-funded plans. 14 years ago, that number was 29%. More and more employers are leaving the fully insured market and moving into the self-insured market. Why is this important? And just so that you know what portions of this pie are covered by the fully regulated or the fully insured market, it's the two pieces of the pie at the bottom. So on the left, the fully insured HMOs, and then on to the right of that, the piece of the pie that's represented by indemnity companies and Blue Cross and Blue Shield. So you can see how those shrunk, and the self-funded plan portion of the pie has really grown. Self-insured plans, as I've mentioned earlier, are exempt from state laws and regulations, including state mandates and state health care taxes. As the cost of care goes up, more and more employers are looking for relief. If an employer is able to self-insure and therefore be exempt under ERISA, the employer can save on the cost of coverage. For example, by self-insuring, the employer saves over 3% by no longer having to pay state health care taxes. And again, I have some tax information in the folder that I provided to you. But those state taxes fall only on the fully insured HMOs and the indemnity and Blue Cross Blue Shield portions of the market. But not every employer is big enough to self-insure. Remember, by self-insuring, the employer is taking on the financial risk. The employer must have the resources to do so. Otherwise, they can get into financial trouble. The difference between the fully insured and the self-insured is an important distinction to understand. Slide 12, I want to talk a little bit about Minnesota's health plans. They offer an array of products for employers. Traditional products that include a traditional HMO that has a tight network of doctors, low office copays, no deductible, to more contemporary products such as high deductible coverage with HSAs and coverage with out-of-network benefits. Health plans also offer their administrative services for a fee to employers that self-insure. They administer the health care benefits for many large employers in Minnesota. So sometimes when someone who works for a large employer like General Mills or 3M, when they look at their, when the employee looks at his or her insurance card and sees one of the local health plans' name on the insurance card, they might think that their insurance, they have insurance with that particular health plan, when in fact those companies, 3M and General Mills and a number of other large self-insured companies, actually are hiring the health plan to administer the insurance benefits for the company. But it's the corporation, the employer itself, that pays all the claims of their employees. The advantage for large employers is that health plans already have made the investment to develop quality provider networks, negotiate rates with providers, review utilization, and most importantly, handle all of the claims. The next page in your packet is a healthcare dollar that's divided up to show you exactly what goes, how much goes for what, how the healthcare dollar is allocated. Physician and hospital services account for about two-thirds of healthcare spending. Prescription drugs and other medical services account for about one-quarter of healthcare spending. And administrative costs account for the rest at about 9% or 9 cents of the dollar for healthcare administrative costs, which includes taxes and assessments. So that gives you a good picture of what what goes into every healthcare dollar. So what drives healthcare cost increases?
Yes, Senator Prater-Solon.
Yes. Ms. Kmit, could I ask you a question about how disease management and patient education fit into administration costs?
Sure. Can I see that back on the on page 13 there?
Yes.
Well, it doesn't have a number, but yes, Ms. Kmit.
Senator Scheid and Senator Solon, that's a good question because that seems like it would be a health care expense. Actually, all of the categories that the health plans report for administrative expense purposes are required, are listed in by the Departments of Health, thank you, and Departments of Commerce, and we have to, we are required to include only certain things in those categories, and we are specifically not allowed to include disease management programs as part of our medical costs. They're categorized as administrative expenses.
So, Senator Prater-Solon.
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Kmit, so there is a standardized reporting form for identifying what are administrative costs?
That Ms. Kmit.
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, that is correct. And all that information is reported directly to the Department of Commerce. The Department of Health uses that information also to produce reports on an annual basis about how much is spent by the health plans for medical costs and for administrative expenses. And we, the health plans, and I'll get into more of this too, but the health plans are also audited on the basis of those reports as well.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Kent, for example, with say let's talk about diabetes, that all of the information, the classes, the material or the supplies, those things that people need to have for disease management, for diabetes, for example, would fit into an administrative cost, you think? I suppose
Madam
the supplies wouldn't, but...
Yeah, Madam Chair, I believe that's correct. If it's part of a disease management program at the health plan, then yes, that particular expense would be categorized under and fall into that segment of the health care dollar.
That's interesting. Senator Olson.
I wasn't sure the things you listed were, what were all the things you listed that you were asking about?
Senator Olson, I was talking about, for example, the management of diabetes in a patient. I'm not sure what the management piece of that is, but I mean, I know that there's a, and I know, understand the, I know where education fits in there, but the management is also checking on the person to make sure they're doing certain things. That can be by phone call, by written survey, whatever, requiring checkups at a certain time, you know, consulting with people, and maybe I also was thinking of the supplies and things that we require them to provide, but that probably doesn't fit under there. It's probably under medical supply payments, the 15-cent piece of the dollar, but I'm just surprised that disease management fits under administrative, as Senator Brettner Solon raised the question.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson.
I know that the plans hire people that generally a doctor or a psychologist or someone would have to call to get permission for a certain course of treatment or to consult with. And those are not people in direct patient contact, but those are people at the management level basically overseeing or supervising the direct care providers. And so I'm wondering whether the disease management piece that you're talking about here under administration is that level of additional supervision or if it includes people who are directly working with the patient.
Ms. Kmit.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I would say that that's probably more of a utilization management function or something that is considered to be, you know, getting prior authorization and that sort of thing. I think that is also part of, has to be recorded as part of the administrative services. I can provide you with some additional information if you'd like to see all the categories.
Ms. Kmit,
I don't know if one of my health plans wants to respond. They're saying that's correct.
Okay.
So let me just keep going.
Senator
here.
Senator Vandeveer had
a
question,
sorry.
I think. That's right. Senator Vandeveer.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Kmit. When we look at the 9% administrative costs, this is for the provider group?
Ms. Kmit.
Madam Chair and Senator Vandeveer, no, this is where the health care dollar goes. The health care dollar that comes into the health plan as the premium dollar, what happens to that dollar? So much of it goes to pay for the cost of physicians, so much goes to pay for inpatient, outpatient hospital. And the administrative portion, it represents the administrative expenses that the health plan has.
The plan. So if I have, Madam Chair, if I have group health or at Blue Cross, and they're the paying this to a nonprofit, Blue Cross paying the money to my provider, which say is Fairview. The Fairview administrative costs are not included in this. That's
Ms. Kmit.
And Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer. Yes, that's correct. We're not counting that. We're not counting the administrative costs at the provider level here in this example. We're just allocating, talking about the allocation of that premium dollar as it goes through the health plan.
As it goes through your party. And one other question, Madam
Chair. Yes, Senator Vandeveer.
Do you know what, looking at your members, what the typical chief executive compensation is for this organization?
Ms. Kmit?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Vandeveer, yes. We do know that information because it's public information and has to be reported on an annual basis. And some, you know, there's a range of salaries.
You have
so,
idea.
Senator Vandeveer, did you want to know those now, or did you?
No,
I don't know.
If we can probably find those later, then if that's public, thank you.
Okay.
Let me
yes,
just
Ms. Kmet.
I'll finish this, and I'll take more questions. So on page 14, where does the health care dollar go? What's driving health care cost increases? And you've heard these comments before, but we are getting older, and we are using more services. And all of these things go to pay for physicians, for inpatient and outpatient hospital visits, prescription drugs, and medical technology and treatments. Although I will say that health plans have been making a foray into using more and more generic drugs, and that's been helping to slow the cost of pharmaceuticals. On the next slide, page 15, I just want to show you some data that comes directly from the Department of Health based on the cost reports that we file with them. And this is just over a two-year period to show you what the increases are in these various categories by type of service. So over a two-year period, physician services were up almost 13%, inpatient hospital up 18.36%, outpatient services up almost 32%, and that might be a reflection of trying to reduce some of the inpatient services and put more at the outpatient level.
Ms. Smith, that's what struck me, that probably doesn't mean that it says healthcare cost drivers, but that may be actually functioning or acting to hold some costs down, the other costs down, right?
Madam Chair, you are correct. That could be a direct response to trying to control inpatient visits. But anyway, you can read this and you can see how the costs are going up, but clearly they are going up faster than the rate of inflation.
Yeah, too.
On page 16, and we've had a little bit of discussion about this, but I do want to talk a little bit more about administrative costs, because there's a lot of talk about administrative costs, and I want to be sure the senators have the facts on this. Administrative costs are growing at the regular rates of inflation. And when we were looking at that dollar, the left side of the dollar is growing at a rate that's 3 to 4 times that of inflation, and that's called medical trend. The administrative costs are growing at the rate of inflation, but if we focus only on administrative costs, we'll never get a handle on all of the rapid growth in healthcare costs. So we really need to – looking at administrative costs is important, but it's also important for you and for all of us to focus on what's really driving healthcare costs, where the big money is. I can also just want to mention that the plans are working together with the provider community to squeeze administrative costs down further. We've been working on some projects, and so we recognize the importance of trying to keep admin costs down to a minimum. I also just want to share with you that the health plans have to demonstrate all of this information by filing reports with all of our regulators on quality measures, our financials, and on our administrative costs. And these categories of spending, as we were talking a little bit earlier, are defined by the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, as well as the state of Minnesota, specify those categories. Health plans are audited annually by the Department of Health, every 3 years by the Department of Commerce, and every 3 years by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. Health plans also have annual independent financial audits, and the health plans are also audited by outside national quality assurance organizations so that they can earn the top ratings that employers look for when choosing a health plan. Health plans also pay for the cost of the state agency and other audits out of their administrative costs. And just one more comment about administrative costs. Not all administrative costs are bad. They actually, there's some good spending that goes to help reduce healthcare costs. For example, trying to detect and prevent fraud and abuse and things like that. So on page 17, and we're almost finished here, a little bit about the commercial coverage overview. We have two different ways to obtain health insurance in the private market. One is through the employer-sponsored group coverage, where the employer purchases the coverage for their employees, and that's usually a very comprehensive package of benefits, but I have to caution here that self-insured plans can have more flexibility of benefit design than others, than the fully insured plans. Fully insured plans have to follow all state laws, including the 62 mandates that Minnesota has. And self-insured plans follow some mandates, typically follow most of the mandates, but not always. There's some premium and cost-sharing flexibility, but again, there's more of that flexibility available for the self-insured. In the individual market, coverage is purchased by individuals, like the self-employed or farmers, and typically they have lower monthly premiums but a higher deductible. The difference between these two types of coverages is that employers choose coverage for their employees, but in the individual market, it's the individual's choice based on their own particular situation. And they pay the premium based on the choices that they make in their policy. I just want to reference that this is not an area that this committee will address, but just want to be sure that you understand that Minnesota also has a whole other segment of business and relationship or partnership with the state of Minnesota through its government programs. And just for a little perspective, in the late 1980s, the cost of providing health care for persons on government programs was growing at a rapid rate in the traditional fee-for-service Medicaid market. And there was also a growing problem of access to providers. There were lots of stories of people on Medicaid who couldn't find a doctor or couldn't find a provider who would see them. Some providers were unwilling to take patients covered by Medicaid. The state explored using managed care plans as a way to gain more access and control the costs better. DHS started with a small demonstration project, and following several years of evaluation, the programs expanded and were eventually broadened statewide. This arrangement gives the state financial stability. For a set fee, the health plans assume the risk and manage the care according to the contract for DHS for the government programs populations. There's also a state requirement that as a condition of licensure, HMOs are required by law to serve government program enrollees. So HMOs don't have a choice, as they do in other states, of whether or not to participate in the Medicaid market or not. In Minnesota, if you do commercial business in a particular county, you must also serve the enrollees in government programs. So that does give a benefit to the state, however, and to enrollees and taxpayers by improving access and services, improved quality, and it's a stable financial stewardship for the state. So they have more predictability. So just in closing, Minnesota has a lot of successes. We're, again, one of the healthiest states, lowest rate of uninsured, very generous benefit sets, and a consumer-friendly environment. Again, I want to stress the importance of nonprofit, locally-based, community-driven organizations.
Senator Johnson has a question or a comment. I don't know. Senator Johnson.
Are you ready for questions?
Oh.
Sure. I was just going to say we still have challenges, but I guess the most important thing that I want to say here is that the biggest challenge we face as a state and as a nation is how to control the rising cost of care. We have a complicated employer-based system that does not include everyone. And that is a problem that we all still pay for, except in a more expensive way. The health plans are homegrown nonprofit organizations with a big stake in the community rather than in shareholders. That is why we're so heavily regulated. And that's why we want to be part of the solution, because we're part of a community. So thank you for your time.
Ms. Kmit, thank you. That's outstanding. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kmit, you started your testimony and you ended your testimony by talking about how in Minnesota we enjoy pretty good health. It might be our environment. It might be our just way of life. I don't know. And you also talked about the quality of health care and our accessibility to good insurance. Am I correct? Is that
Ms. Kmit?
That is correct.
I think that's Chair. Right, yes, Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much for those statements. Is that based on comparison data or based on what?
Ms. Kmet.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, that's a good question.
Right,
that is
together.
Based on comparison data. And I should Let's mention that all of this information comes from data from the Departments of Health or Commerce, DHS, as well as national studies and data that show that Minnesota is consistently ranked very high. The Kaiser Family Foundation also has an excellent program where they look very intensively at state insurance programs in every single state and how different states do better than others.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schmidt, is that information that you can readily pull together? Mike, I guess I'm going to get right to the bottom line. Have you, in Senator Marty's committee, we haven't finished taking testimony. Have you asked to testify in Senator Marty's committee?
Are you referring to a particular bill on Senator Berglund's Senate File 2, Ms. Schmidt?
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, you're talking about Senate File 2?
Yes.
I know there was not a lot of time yesterday to testify, so we did provide the committee members with a letter that listed our both the parts of the bill that we support as well as some other parts of the bill that we have concerns about.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Ms. Kmet, as a member of the of Senator Marty, sorry, this isn't that
no,
this committee.
This is fine. Well, we're going to be getting that bill
but as
soon as Senator Marty is.
As a member of Senator Marty's committee and a new member on that committee, it is very important for me to understand all of these issues. And I think that what you just testified to, I really need to hear in that committee and have an opportunity to have conversation. Could I ask you to present in Senator Marty's committee the information that we just talked about?
Madam Chair.
And I'm sure that Senator Marty welcomes anyone testifying.
Madam Chair,
Senator
I think
Marty.
She's on the list. I think there were four or five groups that wanted to testify that we will get to when we get whatever day is, Monday or whenever.
Yes, Senator Metzen. Or are you?
Yep.
Senator Metzen.
Maybe it's not. You're not the one to ask, Ms. Kim. Kmet, how do you say that? That's pretty good.
She needs to buy a vowel.
We need Vanna White to slip a vowel around.
I have been told to buy a vowel.
We haven't talked about, and maybe you're the wrong group to talk about, R&D and marketing. Maybe we have to get to pharmaceutical.
You were talking about
research and development and marketing. And people will always say one of the reasons drugs are high in Minnesota is because of United States. There's a lot of it's on the research and development. And there's a lot of money spent on marketing. Well, so that drives the cost, like some will argue, double the costs in Minnesota and the United States than in Canada because of the research and development. And I always wonder why, maybe I'm the only one that does, why Europe, Mexico, Canada, and all these other nations, if it's $5 here and it's $10 there and it's $10 in Europe, and or just the opposite, whatever, 10 here, 10 there, 10 there, and 20 here, why should it be 12 there, 12 there, 12 there, 12 there?
So you're talking about the same drug. I don't know.
Yeah, the same drug. And you could argue with me for 100 years and I wouldn't buy into it that the drugs
are... Well, I don't think she was going to argue with
you. The drugs are all different in Canada and they're dying and it's contraband. And I for one, don't believe that. But how the heck do we pay for it? It just seems to me that we're paying for the R&D in this country. And that's one of the arguments, the research and development that we're paying for. Why doesn't everybody else help?
Ms. Kmet, I don't know if you can...
What am I missing?
Answer that, or if there's anybody else that wants to tackle that. Senator Marty does, I think, but Ms. Kmet, if you want to respond.
Marty, answer.
I was just going to say, Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, I'm not an expert in that area, but I would say that I believe the countries that you're talking about in Europe have price controls, and so they're not allowed to charge, or, you know, there's a fixed price. Which we don't have here.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, I would argue that they're not the, none of the companies are losing money in Canada. They're not going to sell them at a loss. They're negotiated prices, and our federal government actually does get great prices for VA drugs. The federal government has refused to negotiate. They prohibited, Congress prohibited them from negotiating on Medicaid Part D drugs. And frankly, health plans do a pretty good job of negotiating for their members in terms of the prices. People who really get stuck here are the ones who are buying on their own, people who aren't, do not have prescription drug coverage through their health plans. So I would argue it's not that the others are paying too little. It's that profits of the pharmaceutical industry are about three times what any other industry in the country is. And it's true. They're very high, and I would argue we're overpaying. They're not underpaying.
Senator Van de Veer.
Well, we had someone who claimed to have been the deputy commissioner or something from Canada, and he was telling us that at the time they implemented their plan, of course, this was in the House, so I don't know if this is useful information.
What?
Probably not. Probably not.
Senator Vandiver, share it with us anyway. We'll weigh it.
Use your own discernment.
The disclaimer is helpful.
The comment, his statement was that they simply told the drug companies that if they didn't give them the prices they wanted, they wouldn't honor their patent. So kind of goes along with the idea that we pay the R&D and then they get the discounts, but anyway.
And there are other sides to this as well. Some of us who need some of the new drugs have a strong interest in seeing that they are developed, that the research continues.
That's very true.
Madam Chair, that's true.
That's
but the others have to help us pay for that.
No, I know, Senator Metzen. I just, there's a balance there someplace, and I don't think we're at it in this country right now. You're right. Ms. Kmit, thank you so much. Does anybody have any other questions? Thank you so much. That was very helpful to us because we will see, you know, the bills that come out of the Health Insurance Committee. Thank you so much. I want to thank Mr. Johnson, and I want to thank Ms. Rowan and wish her well. And members, we don't think you're going to have that bill reported out, right, for us by next Monday. So
Monday is when we're next.
You probably will. So members, I think we will be meeting then on Thursday, a week from today, right? Not on Tuesday.
I don't get a chance.
And that will be Senator Betzold's statewide health care coverage for education.
Yeah, my son went to Mexico.
The meeting's adjourned. Thank you, members. Thank you for all for staying.